fascism was like?
In Japan, as I recall, and I can remember very strong debates on those sorts of questions, because those were questions related to peace, anti-war struggles. They were very great. I can remember, the woman now, I've forgotten her name. It's so long since I've thought about it, but I think she, seems to me, was either from the International League for Peace and Freedom or... But I shouldn't say that because I can't remember exactly. I'd have to think back on that. I'll ask Erling about it because they remember so well. Because no matter who comes to Vancouver, who was ever in the Youth Congress, they always get to my brothers from all over the place, from England. And last summer there were people here from Edmonton, from England, from France, and all over the place. So, you know, they maintain a very, my pursuits have been quite a lot different, you know, over the years, so I don't remember so well about that. But I know we did discuss the questions of peace, and at that time, you see, there was still a lot of unemployment.
Right, yeah.
That didn't change until really the war broke out. There was a slight beginning, and then of course there was the Spanish War. That was also a very big on the agenda, and I can remember meetings, you know, where... Dr. Benjamin came, for example, and I can remember him speaking in a theater or something, and you know, we went to that, and I know Nigel was in Victoria at the time, and I can remember writing him about that meeting and things like that, and then of course there was the whole question of scholarships for students so that they could have some education, and there were also questions related to domestics. Did you by any chance talk to Mildred Liversidge?
I have her name. I think she's on the island.
Yes, and she's a very sick woman. Her husband was the one who wrote On to Ottawa Trek.
Uh-huh.
And she did some work in relation to organizing domestics. He was a very staunch person.
Okay, did you ever get involved with any of the domestic organizations?
No. At that time, I wasn't in touch with anybody, you know, and my nose was to the grindstone. I used to just go home, you know, and of course our home was always such an interesting place anyway, that in my off time, you know, I went home and enjoyed that. So, and whatever cultural activities there were in the Icelandic community, you know, we were involved in that. So what little time I had. You know, we did that.
The Youth Congress movement, would they organize demonstrations around these issues? Would they hold public meetings? What kind of activities did
they used to have? I don't remember how often the meetings were, whether they were once a month. I really don't remember. I can check it. I think rather than give you a whole lot of stuff on that mightn't be too accurate, it would be much better if I had a talk with my brother and my sister-in-law, as a matter of fact, because she was involved with, you see, all these things were sort of intertwined. She was involved with they called it International House at UBC. And as a matter of fact, they were at a wedding Saturday night in which a Japanese woman from there who had married one of the fellows that we knew in the Youth Congress, I think, and they got married, and their daughter was being married. So those are the kind of things that happened, you know.
Right.
But there were all sorts of relationships, and...
Okay, so we'll leave that.
Yeah, and I'll make a note about that, because I think we should know more about that anyway. That is a chapter, because it was national, and it was very influential, actually. So I should really get a lot more about that. See, in those days, I was very, very retiring, and I didn't do anything like get up in a meeting and speak. I mean, I'd have been caught dead first. And I was just sort of, I was just a very much of a background person, or I would do typing, or I would do things like that. But I, you know, I was very much in the background. So anyway, I'll get that info.
Was there any discussion of organization when you worked at in your office job? Because they were organizing the plants.
I know, and there was a very little bit of discussion about it. Just trying to think. I'm sure I opened my mouth much too much when I was there without realizing it. Mm. You know, I'm sure that a lot of them thought that I had really had some really funny ideas, or probably even had come to the conclusion that I was a bit of a red because I might have thought I was being very diplomatic or something like that. But looking back on it now, I'm not sure. I think I probably opened my mouth much too wide sometimes, you know. So there was very little talk of organization. Because you see, in those days, don't forget, unionism was as taboo then, mm-hmm. as the Communist Party is today. I can even remember discussing with one of the girls as we were walking at lunchtime about the horrors I felt about the Spanish War. And she had no difficulty in being able to rationalize that. but then you see, the CCF didn't play a very good role in that either, you know.
Could you not hear that?
They took a position of neutrality.
In the war in Spain.
Yeah. And Finland, too. Now, I had a real battle, and that was a very difficult thing for me in our Icelandic women's group. On the question of Finland, because the girl who was president, she was a real liberal, and she brought in a resolution one time into the meeting without discussing it with the executive. She just brought it in relation to I think it was aid to Finland or something like that. And you know, you'd have to know the history of that point to know that that was a, you know, I didn't know what to do. It was just, you know, I thought, oh, how awful. What a position to be in, you know. And anyway, I managed to get it put off for until the next meeting. And then we had about, I was able to muster about 6 or 7 or something, or 8, I don't remember. It was quite a little group that voted against it, but she won because, you know, they were real rednecks. So anyway, those are some of the things that happened.
Okay, that takes us then up to, those are my questions, up to around 1941. Oh, you mentioned working in the CIO office.
Yes.
Is that was it, what it was called, the CIO office?
Yes, it was the CIO Industrial Union Council.
Mm-hmm. What did they say to me when they fired you?
Well, they just said that there were so many people who were not married who should have jobs, and married women shouldn't be working and taking jobs.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it.
Okay, so
mind you, that was only half that story too.
Okay, what's the other half?
The other half, if I hadn't been married to Nigel Morgan, they probably wouldn't have fired me so easily.
So they were afraid of?
You know, radical mm-hmm. politics.
You mentioned before that you had been sort of shy and retiring. When did that start to change, and what was that process?
Uh, I think, mind you, not that I ever liked it, but I think when I had to take positions in the auxiliary movement, I joined the auxiliary, you know, fairly quickly after we were married, and before long, we had a, I can't remember what year the district council was organized. It might have even been organized when I joined. But anyway, before very long, I became one of the officers of the district council. And then, you know, I had to be in a position where you spoke on questions. And then the worst of it was that I went a couple of times with Nigel to the island, you know, and they're, oh, you know, they'd like me to speak too. Oh, gosh. That was devastating. Anyway, I guess that happens to a lot of people. When you suddenly have to, or you're put in a position where you have to make statements, you know, and... You have no choice. You have to do something, you know. So, I guess it was at that time that I came out of myself more.
All right. So, you worked in the IWA office and you were also a member of the auxiliary.
Oh yes, well, that was just as the wife of a woodworker, a union member.
Okay. I think what I'll do is I'll ask you some questions about working for the IWA, and then I'll ask you about the auxiliary.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
When you worked for the IWA, that was during the war, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Can you just run over a bit of what you recall about the history of the union in that period of time? What was
yeah.
that?
It was just beginning to be organized. You see, the IWA was formed in 1937 in Portland. Harold Prichette from BC became its first president, and and the BC District Union Council was chartered. And it was the first union chartered under the CIO in BC. And see, before that, they'd had the lumber sawmill workers and so on. And the CIO was the beginning of organizing industrial unions, where they were trying to get one union in one industry and have the strength of the whole woodworking industry, as opposed to the division of the craft unions. And so it was, the struggle to organize the CIO was extremely difficult as well, because again, it was all the red bogey was always used to try to change that. Now there are some very interesting quotes, and I have them here somewhere, where Philip, well, before Philip Murray, but it was John L. Lewis,
mm-hmm.
John L. Lewis, who swept aside that, and he said, you know, that you're never going to organize anything if you're going to allow those kind of divisions. And although he was a mine owner himself, but he became a very influential, as you know, a person. And and here the struggle was reflected, and. I can remember discussions even among some of the people that I had grown up with, some of the guys who, you know, we got together socially, and they were saying, oh, the CIO, you know, that's just a bunch of reds and this sort of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really big struggle to organize the CIO. And I know when Nigel came into the district council, he was in Victoria, and when he was made secretary treasurer, they had under 300 members. So you can imagine what kind of a job it was. to maintain an office, keep the lumber worker going, keep the Laura Wayne, which was called the Logger's Navy, keep it going. And so most of the people who worked there worked for very little, and sometimes there wasn't enough to pay. And but they were all so dedicated people that they worked to build the union and maintain it. And I can remember one of the things that I had to do when I went to work for Local 71, because everybody would be out in the field. Often at 9 o'clock at night, I would rush down to the Union steamships with the mail that had to go out for the camps. And I never resented that. I never thought anything about it, except it was part of the job you did.
So you felt like you were part of the organizing process?
Well, that's right, because you became everybody in the in those early days that worked in the union, that's the way you felt, because the unions were being organized, and they weren't looked on as a big outfit that could maintain itself at that point. And the organizing was done. I can remember even before Harold came up. No, it was after, of course, because he wasn't here at that time. I wasn't in the office at that time. They would go out and meet groups of people just in their houses to try to get them to come into the union, It was a one-on-one sort of a deal often. And when they went out to the camps, they would have to go in the dead of night sometimes and get into the bunkhouse when the guys were sleeping and wake up somebody that they knew in there, try to find out where they were. Because if the boss knew they were in camp, it was out.
Yeah.
And they used all sorts of, in order to get guys' names even in the plants, they would run raffles. They'd raffle a bottle of whiskey or something like that, to find out who was working where, what was the names of the guys, so they could go and see them at their homes. Now this, people don't realize today what building the industrial unions was.
It was illegal, wasn't it, to organize? Like, there was no legal status for unions,
was no. I can't remember when that came in.
43, I think.
Was it 43 that they actually got that bill?
Yeah.
Bill 39, I can remember, was one of the things we worked very hard for. Yeah, it was a really tough struggle. But you looked on it as something that was happening. And of course, you always had those that, in their own way, tried to break everything. I can remember when they, and I would take the minutes, at district council meetings. sometimes, not always, because one of the other girls and one of the other locals would do it, but it was, because Nigel would be going, it was just as good for me to go, as to stay home. So quite often I would do that. And so then, you watch these, they used to call them the white block. And some of those guys, the shenanigans that they went through in order to try to avoid all the good things that the others were doing, It was a real, real struggle.
What about women in the IWA in those days? Were there women working in the industry?
Yes, but not many.
Mm-hmm. And when did they come in what condition?
I guess during the war, of course, like everywhere else. There was even the odd woman faller, but very few. I only actually knew one.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Did you tell me a bit about her circumstances? I never knew that there were women.
Yes, well, but she was the type of woman who... I don't think she did it so much for the fact that the wages were so good, as that she just enjoyed the fact of registering, her independence and wanting to do something that was really different. Mm. I can't say that I knew her terribly well, but I can remember her coming into the union office, But in the mills, of course, like in BC Ply, was like we had a woman organizer.
Oh yeah.
Hilland, yes, yeah. Gladys Hilland, and that was in Local 217. in the Sawmill Local in Vancouver. And of course, Alice Person has worked in the mills for how many years? Years and years and years. You met her, haven't you? Yes. For years and years and years, she was there.
Did the women come into the union office with any kinds of specific problems or issues?
I would say not anymore, and not as nearly as much as the men. Mind you, I was in the loggers' local. I worked in the loggers' local, and then later in the district. I don't think I worked in the district while Nigel was there. I think I worked there after he left. I was there, you see, for 3 years after he was gone.
So you wouldn't come into contact that much with Randy Paul?
No, not of the women, because
yeah.
The loggers were, you know, it was the loggers' local that I worked in longest.
What about equal pay for equal work? Was that an issue that was current during the war?
Yes, there was a certain amount of that, mm-hmm. But mind you, I didn't come across it that much because I wasn't in that area, you know.
Sure.
We heard about it, but I must say that I didn't. Alice would know much more about that. She'd
yeah.
be able to give you that story, or Gladys.
What about, I guess it's an analogy in some ways with the equal pay issue for women and men, but were there issues between workers of different races in the industry?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Oh, yes. Yes. You see, in the early days, I can remember particularly on the island hearing Nigel talk about how they used to make the Chinese workers, and I suppose it applied to East Indian workers as well, pay them for giving them a job. And they collected every month. And that was one of the things that the IWA addressed and won. They took some people to court, I think, over that, it seems to me, but they won it anyway, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was quite bad. And, you know, there was that same division that you find amongst workers even today, where they think, oh well, some of these immigrants, you know, they come here and there aren't enough jobs for everybody and so they shouldn't have them, you know. It was that. There was a certain amount of that. I don't know what percentage of others worked. See, in the loggers, local, I can't remember coming across that so much because a large number of them were Swedish and Norwegian. You know, they were craftsmen when they already came, a lot of them. And there were a lot of Ukrainians
mm-hmm.
in the woods, and some Germans.
Mm-hmm. So this was a mill problem to some extent?
I think it was more of a mill problem.
Okay. Do you remember, this is a difficult question, I don't know if I can even say it right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember in which ways policies that, I guess it would have been the Labour Progressive Party at that time had, how they would be argued inside the union and how they would affect the direction of the union? Because that a lot of the leadership people were
mm-hmm.
party members.
Yes, quite a few of them were. not all of them, though. Well, it's like everything else.
Mm-hmm.
If proposals are put forward, then you always have somebody who doesn't accept them. And certainly, there was complete democracy there because, like, the I must tell you about John McCush. I'm sure other people have mentioned him to you. He was the president and one of the organizers of the local once at the loggers local local 171, and he was a rough-hewn prince of a person. He had been everywhere. He was born in Nova Scotia. He had been in various parts of the United States, Hawaii. Every place he went, he was for the working man. And one of the first jobs I had when I went to work for the for the union was to phone a list of people he gave me. He said, now you try and get those characters out of bed to come to the union meeting. He said, we want everybody we can get to come to the union meeting, you know. And so, you know, naturally what happens, I don't know if you've ever worked with loggers or know anything about it. When they come to town, after they've been out in the woods for a period, you know, they're bushed.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes the first thing that happens is that they deposit all their stuff someplace. They used to bring a lot of their stuff to the IWA, to the union office. They'd bring their money in there, you know, we'd have to keep it in there. We had a great big wall safe, and wall safe, it was a whole room practically. But anyway, and then they would go on a toot, or they'd go to the, you know, they'd go to the beer parlor and so on. And not all of them, because some of them were married people, but the single ones, you know, they get themselves a hotel room and then they would have fun, and often they got rolled if they didn't get to the union office first. And so anyway, McCush, when you know, McCush, he spoke like this, you know, lower than a snake's belly, that guy. You know, those are the kind of things he would say, you know. But completely principled person. But they did. They tried very, very hard to get guys out to union meetings. Because, you know, how do you organize if you don't get people out?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same thing in Local 217. When they had a meeting, they would get, you know, as many people as they could possibly muster. Today you can't get people to union meetings unless there's some hot issue. But in those days, one of the reasons that some of them didn't want to come out to a meeting was they'd be identified as being union members.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't always want everybody to know who they, you know, that they were union members.
It was like a volunteer sign-up.
Yes, sure. That's, oh yes, for a long time. I forget what, I don't even remember when they got the check off. It was a long time after. No, it was collecting dues and, you know, it was a really a tough job to keep the whole thing going, you know. So that if any policies that were projected in the union meeting, first of all, it would be done in the executive, and then the executive would take it to the union meeting and it would be discussed. And I can remember lots of real hot discussions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, after Harold Prichette left, there was a change in the leadership of the International Union, and some of the officers were something. As a matter of fact, I came across a bit in one of the lumber workers that I don't know what made me keep these things, but I did, and I didn't realize I had them. But one of them is where Mr. Fadling, who was quite a bit later, but he went to the province and put an ad in the province newspaper, which had been on strike. I can't remember where that is now. But anyway, the international officers at one point, they were very, very, well, it really led to the breakup, you know, when the union disaffiliated. It was just the pressure, you know, of that endless fight that finally led to it, you know.
So the union, the international union, was hostile to
the district. Mm-hmm. Oh yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And came out publicly against them. I had forgotten some of those things too, but I came across it right in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they actually came out publicly, and that was in 1948.
Around what issues did the hostility come out? Was it ever around contract issues?
Everything. Uh-huh. Everything. Because you see, even the whole question of district wide negotiations,
mm-hmm,
is a progressive policy. And if people are not interested in organizing a union for the benefit of everybody, they just have their own little empire to, you know, service, then they're not necessarily going to be that interested in industry-wide negotiations. They're rather going to think a little bit more, how much can I get out of this in mind? For example, it took a long time for the shingle weavers, and Harold was a shingle weaver. But there was another group that was much longer, I forget who it was, that took such a long time before they even, you know, got them in, because they had that the craft mentality, actually. Mm-hmm. And so this, you see, in unity there is strength is a progressive slogan. Mm-hmm. And if a boss can get a union organizer to fight against that, he's going to win something, eh? And you know, the union movement has been riddled with bosses' agents since the day when. I'll show you some here afterwards about some very interesting things that, and I can remember taking the minutes of that meeting, you know, where a guy, they actually found what had happened. It's all there. I'll show you. So it wasn't just the question of labor progressive policies, but, you know, the whole question of developing strong unions like it is today. Right now, the Bennett government is very busy trying to organize ways of breaking up the existing union strength that there is. And you can imagine how much tougher it was, mm-hmm, in the building of the union to be able to carry it through. And the first contract, when the first contract was signed, I've got a picture of Nigel with that crew, you know, that signed that very first contract. You can imagine what. And you know what happened to that logging operator? They almost ruined him. They did all sorts of things on his operation, and they threatened him.